There's always a FIMREG angle, the podcast providing you with the latest news and commentary on financial regulation. Brought to you by Global Custodian.
Hello and welcome to the second episode of Season 5 of There's Always a FinReg Angle. I'm John Watkins, Managing Editor of Global Custodian, and I'm joined virtually, as always, by a pair of FinReg experts, Sean Tuffy and Virginia O'Shea. Welcome both.
Hello there.
Hello.
I'm guessing you've both been pretty busy lately, given how hard it's been to actually schedule this second episode. Virginia, more operational resiliency stuff?
That never ends, does it? I mean, there's been so many different bloody proposals over the last few weeks and months. So, yes, lots of stuff on that, lots of stuff on post-trade, which I'm sure we'll get to in a second.
I'm sure we will. And thanks for getting the curse word in to make us an explicit episode within the first minute. Yeah, thank you. I've written a feature on operational resiliency. So thanks for your white paper, for being the entire basis of it. But it was enjoyable. I don't know if I'd want to write about it as much as you seem to be doing all the time. But I guess you're speaking to the ops teams as well, right?
Yes, I think there's a lot of confusion about, because there are so many different regs and what the crossover is amongst them. I mean, DORA is probably the most comprehensive one. And we're still waiting for more consultation. Well, no, not consultation. We've got the consultations now, all of them, but we're waiting for more regulatory technical standards to be finalised. So we're still not done on DORA, and it's coming closer and closer, given it's in January, right?
Yikes.
Yeah, and any chance of an extension, or is just a bit of look the other way for a year?
I really don't think so, just because it's such a priority, and every regulator, because of so many different... I guess cybersecurity incidences and outages and things like that, and market infrastructures, and at banks and other vendors. I think it's really prioritised that topic for a lot of regulators above many other things. So I don't think we'll see an extension.
Good. You heard it here first. Sean, we got a lot of settlement, T+1 across the world, CSDR penalties today to talk about, but what else has been capturing your attention lately?
Right, yeah, I mean, before we dive into the world of post-trade settlement, T+1, I mean, I think the only other big regulatory story since we last got together is sort of, I really would say the SEC got kind of taken to the woodshed on its ESG rules. So it released watered-down ESG rules, which enraged everybody, and they got sued by business lobbies and environmental lobbies together. One side claiming the rules were too weak, the other claiming they were too strong. And they threw up the white flag yesterday and said they're suspending the implementation of the ESG rules pending the outcome of the lawsuits. So it was a rough landing for the ESG rules that have been sort of a priority of the SEC this term.
The rock and the hard place, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is, and I know we've discussed it before, sort of the ambitious agenda, to put it euphemistically, of the SEC has really kind of backed itself into a corner, and they've been sued over the last couple of rules they've put out there because you can do that in the US. And I just think trying to roll out a European style regulatory blitz without a legislative backing was always going to lead to trouble. So I think people kind of smell blood in the water and are going to sue the SEC over anything they try to put out now. So, the one everyone is paying attention to is the liquidity rules and potential mandatory swing pricing. And if the SEC goes ahead with mandatory swing pricing, they will get sued by everybody. So I think it's just sort of an interesting dynamic we have now, where the agenda of the SEC has been sort of stuck in the mud a little bit. And you see the same on the crypto side, where they've had court wins and court losses, but they're sort of spinning their wheels a little bit.
It'd be interesting to track how many lawsuits there are against the SEC at the moment, actually.
Yeah, there are a bunch. I mean, there are a bunch on the crypto side, and then on the traditional side, the private fund rules are being challenged. The ESG rules are being challenged. I think there's another one. They've just run into... I think they've sort of run out of road. And so the only ones that really aren't being challenged are the new money market fund rules, but that's because people kind of understand the need for those changes after the the 2020 COVID-related market spasm. So I just think it's sort of, when you go to overhaul your regulatory framework without a major event to justify it, you're going to run into trouble, especially in America, where like there's a little more dysfunction when it comes to sort of the process.
Very true.
Right, well, look, I really want to get back to settlement. I should never have opened the door.
sorry.
The operational resilience and a whole settlement episode planned. If we mentioned crypto or Bitcoin today, your keyboards are both tied to electronic systems, which will shock you at the very mention of it. Although we may have 5 minutes for the SBF trial, just for banter at the end of the call. So look, T plus one, where should we start? Why don't we start in the US? Because it's actually happening. Rather than the UK and Europe's 2027 plans. Big thing seems to be affirmation rates right now. They seem to be worryingly low and only edging up very marginally in the build-up. So we have, I know everyone seems to do a countdown at the moment, but then I lose track. What are we, 50 days to go, 60 days to go, something
depends
like that?
Depends if you're counting working days or just weeks, right?
Oh, that's right. That's why everyone keeps saying different numbers. People should explain this more.
It's far fewer on working days. Like I think we're under 40 now, I think, maybe.
Well, there's so many public holidays in the world in May as well.
Yeah.
It's essentially tomorrow. What do you think about the affirmation rates? Reason for worry? Or will we just last minute scramble to get there?
Do you want to go first, Sean, or shall I?
You can go ahead.
I think it's reason to worry. I mean, certainly it's not unexpected, though, because I think everybody, and I've been speaking to a lot of different firms, obviously, constantly on this topic, and everybody drags their heels on this front, right? And I think there's been a lot of debate between brokers, their clients, about, you know, signing paperwork related to this. Even the SEC exams division referenced that in a recent alert about the fact that they are worrying about the paperwork not being signed for affirmation as well, because there is also an obligation in the incoming requirements related to signing on the part of the buy side and agreeing to affirm on same day affirmation. So I think there's a lot of gaps. Affirmation is one area, but there's, you know, all the other areas are even less further advanced in terms of like the asset servicing aspects and everything else. So, and FX, dare I mention. So I think all of it's sort of slightly scary.
It could be a whole episode in itself, couldn't it? FX and funding.
Exactly.
Yeah, Sean, what do you think? I mean, affirmation for me is just maybe the most, it'd be a recency bias there, just because the rates have just come out. But Sean, what's keeping you up at night with T plus one?
Yeah, I mean, so I think we should be worried. I mean, we've talked about it for over a year now. I think part of it, though, is these sort of big projects are always sort of a mess as right before you get to the live date. So I think that, and I think there is sort of a tendency of the industry, in particular on the buy side, to sort of push everything to the last minute, because half the, you know, up until like 2 weeks ago, they were assuming their custody nerds would just take care of this for them and didn't realize they had to do stuff. Which is part of the problem. But I think bigger picture, the thing about T plus one, which I think, Virginia mentioned FX is an issue, but then there's, you know, the second order effects that I've mentioned before around sort of fund settlement in the EU in particular, sort of UCITS settlement cycles needing to speed up. And there's a real problem with the potential problem with UCIT ETFs. If they, you know, if they're U.S. secure, if they hold U.S. securities or a substantial amount of securities, because the settlement cycles are going to be off a little bit, and there's a big problem with sort of cash on hand and overdrafts that UCITS ETFs may run into because of the way they do sort of cash dealing for in European ETFs. So I think those are sort of headache problems that people aren't really paying attention to because they're sort of second order effects. But I think they are things that people are going to have to come to terms with.
There seems to be, I mean, every man and his dog with a blog seems to be writing about T plus one at the moment, but there seems to be a confusion around, you know, the fact that obviously there's no penalties for assessment fails in the US like there is in Europe, but that doesn't mean the SEC can't come down hard on you at some point in the future, right? If you're not complying with this.
Well, that's that's what the SEC was threatening in that sort of alert there on the exam side, because they will come down hard on the brokers. Not they can't really directly come down hard on the buy side, which is part of the problem. So the brokers will have to pass through some of the costs of this to their asset managers, or their end clients, but it'd be their banks or asset managers. So that's where we're going to get into sticky water as to actually who ends up paying for a lot of this stuff. If settlement efficiency rates are very low for a certain group of clients, we've never really had it priced in before. And that's where I think this is where people are sort of have. I did a blog about it on GC, right? About this standoff between who pays for it, between buy side and sell side. And that's not going to get sorted for a little while after implementation, if you ask me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it will be interesting. Let's assume for the minute that we stick to the May live date. You know, SEC actually has sort of already put a shot across the bow that they're going to look at enforcement or whatever. But, you know, I imagine the summer would be, unless there's some horrifying things happening, that classic best efforts basis allowance by the industry, by the regulator. And then the SEC probably would start looking more seriously towards the end of the summer and the fall to see if they need to take any action from an enforcement perspective to if things don't improve. So I would imagine they sort of bake in a little bit of choppiness for the sort of June, July, August period. And then we'll sort of reassess where we are in the fall.
It depends on what fail rates look like. So I think, I mean, obviously I'm anticipating it's going to be up to 30% maybe increase in fails.
Yeah.
Maybe more than that, depending. We don't know yet, because it's a bit of a big question here in terms of how prepared everyone really is. But how long that goes on for is the real question. And then does the SEC take steps to try and introduce something that's round penalties? Because they will take steps if they feel it's not coming down quick enough. And you say there's no penalty regime in the US. There is for fixed income, right? So it's not mandatory, but there is the TMPG guidelines where after Lehman Brothers, they brought in, because there were so many fails in fixed income, they brought that in for treasuries. So and that's quite high. So I think, you know, the industry is probably not going to bring it in, but the regulator might.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, I think. I mean, I think it really is. I think it's a great point. If there's a huge spike, which we all expect there to be, but then it comes down relatively quickly, I think it'll be sort of a no harm, no foul attitude. But if it's sort of a huge spike and it doesn't come down, I think you're right, that's where the SEC might take a more pointed interest.
That's interesting you said that, because there's not really a watermark for success here, but you're saying that if it's, you know, we expect to see the spike, but then it's what happens after that.
Right. It's one of those things that they're not going to publish what their watermarks are, because they want it to work. So they're not going to give, you know, you give an inch, the industry will take a mile. So you have to I think I would assume mentally they have sort of these internal targets. And then if they come down and there's progress, then it probably won't be. Then it's a matter of if there are any laggards that are just not doing it, not improving things at all. But I think I don't imagine them coming out of the gates 2 weeks into it, like trying to crack skulls.
Yeah,
things are looking better. I guess that's basically it. Like,
and there's no watermark in Europe as well. Remember, John, right? So ESMA hasn't, or the European Commission haven't said this is what good looks like in terms of settlement efficiency.
Right.
So,
well, they're moving the goalposts, aren't they? Yeah. In their stats. You look at their stats. It seems to be, a bit like how the weather forecasts now have 30 degrees in bright red, where they used to have it in, light green. like you say, there's not a watermark, but I guess there was an average kind of COVID, mm-hmm. right? And then when it spiked above it and stayed above it, then that's in the not good range.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Which is funny, because at least in Europe, the pre-COVID number was in the not good range. But now, we would love to be back to that.
What do you think, what do you think about custodians' parts in this? I've heard, if I take two recent comments, one person said to me, the silence of custodians on this matter is deafening, just in T+1 in general. And then others have kind of praised them for their outreach behind the scenes that maybe some of us don't see. But what do you think about how they've gone about educating and engaging with T+1?
Well, so I think it depends on who you're comparing them to. So, I mean, I have been talking to a lot of buy side ops people, and they say the custodians are much louder than the brokers. The brokers and prime brokers, yeah, especially, are deafeningly silent, even in the US. So I think some custodians have been more active than others, but I certainly think they're much more active than some of the other market participants. So depends on who you compare them to.
Yeah, really interesting. And I guess they've got some decisions still to make around their own internal deadlines. Talking about FX, the report recently from a farmer, did you see that one? About CLS,
yes,
cutoffs?
Yes.
Yeah. It was quite one-sided. There wasn't much on that, I got to admit. We actually, when we wrote the story, we went to CLS, like, hey, what do you think about this? Because they've written about you without really asking. But, that was seemed to be mostly around people missing the custodian cutoffs rather than the actual CLS ones.
I mean, it also had an air of panic, didn't it, that from the buy side? It seemed really quite hyperbolic. Not that it hasn't got grounds for being slightly panicked, but I think there's a lot of, confusion and fear about what happens to international investors post-May.
Yeah, agreed. What do you both, the last thing on the US, what do you think about just the massive information that's out there? Obviously, this is getting picked up by the FT. I don't know, it might even be the Telegraph. I don't know, it's so mainstream now. Let's take the buy side, because they're the ones facing some of the biggest challenges. But how do they go about in the last 50, 60 or 70 days, how much we decided it was, tapping into the right information to help themselves to prepare?
I mean, I think it's having to speak to their counterparts. It's the communication with the people that you're connected to and that have to do things with you and agree things with you that you have to worry about, not necessarily the bigger picture. Because I think everybody has, I'm saying this and not meaning it, but in the US, I think most people know exactly what the list of things they have to do is.
Absolutely.
But they may not know how far down that list they've got as an organization, because it involves multiple bits of their business. And likewise, their counterparts will be in the same position. So it's all about communicating with anyone you're connected to that you're dependent on, and finding out what needs doing. That's my opinion, anyway.
Yeah, you agree, Sean?
Yeah, no, I think it's one of those sort of classical, huge sort of market changing event. For all organizations, it hits across your entire org. And just having the sort of PMO or project management discipline to know exactly where you are and know where your counterparties are is hard. So I think right now, the reason it's in, as you said, it's in the mainstream press, and it's sort of a bit of a panic at the disco moment, is because the deadline's getting close and it's hard to have a view of where you are as an organization on something like this with so many moving parts. So I just think it's really, as Virginia said, it's really try to get that view of where you are down the list, and more importantly, where, especially on the broker dealer side, where your counterparties are on their list. And I think that goes back, John, to your point about sort of the role of the custodians. Traditionally in these events, buy side will lean on the custodian for market intel, if not sort of soft project management for them. And so I think it's just sort of, when it doesn't really involve the custodians as much as it does other market participants, it's a little harder for that dynamic.
Yeah. Yeah, from the content side, I think, like you said, we just need to be very, obviously, like you said, Virginia, you're going to have conversations with counterparts, but from an information perspective, it's just got to be a bit more niche now, I think. It's got to be a bit more focused on specific issues.
The biggest worry is really the front office people, right? Because obviously most of the time they chuck stuff over their shoulders and they don't care about post-trade. So if they're sort of fed misinformation, because they will be relying on other sources, they won't ask their internal people. Quite often that's what causes panics. So if they're relying on unreliable information, which some of it is, let's face it, then that could be problematic as an organization. Yeah. But that's the only worry point.
I think that's right. Yeah. And they're in the front office. I think you're right. They're going to be relying on when it hits the mainstream press, that's when the front office is going to pay attention anyway. So Like, honestly, like, they haven't, like, they've been probably tangentially aware of this, but now that it's in Bloomberg and the FT, like, now they're going to, and that's where they're going to get their information. And they might, like, Google it slightly, but
yeah.
I mean, that's where they are going to get their information from the mainstream press. So it really depends on, like, how alarmist Bloomberg or the FT or whoever, Wall Street Journal, is in their coverage. It's going to drive their perception of where things are, because they're not, you know, they're not going to be reading, like, you know, niche articles from, like, lawyers or consultants or whatever. So they're really going to be relying on the mainstream press to guide them.
Yeah, which that is, unfortunately, alarmist and broad. So it's
right. That's a challenge. Like, yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Although, Virginia, your research was, you know, had that nearly a trillion number. So that was also quite.
I'm not sure it was alarmist. I mean, it was. We spent a lot of time getting those numbers. So, I mean, it's realistic, given not many people look at these sort of these costs in such a comprehensive manner, I think. And we had to take into account so many components. That's why it took so long, like 12 months plus of research and talking to people. So, yeah.
Incredible. Look, I did the job of rounding it up to a trillion for you. You have to be more accurate in your research, but, you know, I'll be the clickbait. It's fine. I mean, it was nearly a trillion, give or take a few.
It was.
Million, so. Look, let's talk quickly about the UK, because they've just announced their own plans. Task Force had a bit of back and forth by the sounds of it. It seems like a lot of people were on there, a lot of strong views, and it took them a little bit longer to get to the point where they released these recommendations, and ultimately it's probably what we all thought it would be anyway. But it seemed to be a little bit on the fence in terms of, look, by the end of 2027, but also let's see what Europe does.
I don't know. You talk about misinformation in the press. The reporting of this in mainstream press has really annoyed me, I must admit.
Oh, go on. You can, if it's me, just tell me. It's fine.
No. It's been all the papers. So I think, especially the one that's, we've got a cabal of right-wing papers out there, obviously, but a lot of them don't understand the Brexit impact, or like the fact that aligning ourselves with the US would do us absolutely no favours at all. And they're sort of picking holes in these recommendations, saying, you know, why are we waiting for Europe? And, you know, this sort of tone of not understanding exactly why the city, and, you know, talking about the people in the city that are recommending to wait and criticising for no good reason, right? That just irritates me.
I think they think that, we had our chance to get an advantage, get an edge here. But it's not really an edge going first. If anything, it's you know, disaster. They'll just sit back again. Europe will sit back and go, okay, now we get to learn lessons from the US and the UK and then do it much better. But I know the article you're talking about now, Virginia.
Yeah.
We missed our chance to make the most of Brexit, really. What was it? Flex our Brexit, post-Brexit muscles.
Indeed. Which is laughable, to be fair, but you know, it's a trope that's common across a lot of those different publications, and we can always anticipate it. And I think that's what put pressure on some of the working group members, right? Or the task force members. Sorry, I can't call them a working group, can I? Even if that's what they are, task force sounds much more. What's the words like? Dramatic, doesn't it? And military-like. But I think I can understand why there was pressure, because, you know, politicians don't get this stuff either. You know, plumbing is beyond the realms of their comprehension. So understanding why you would wait and align with Europe doesn't really make sense to them. So they were putting a lot of pressure on those members to move. But thankfully, sense ruled out, if you ask me, in the recommendations. So I'm sure Sean agrees on that.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I mean, like, I don't think the median Brexit voter was voting for Brexit in order to improve, to speed up settlement time. Like, I don't think that was at all. And it's always funny when the right wing or the Brexit press picks up these really sort of obscure financial topics and trumpets them as a potential opportunity. But I think, I think when you look at the overall report or recommendations, I mean, I think as much as we make fun of T+1 in the US, and I've been pretty vocal that it was pretty wholly unnecessary. Like, it's happened, or it's happening. And so, like, I don't think the Europe or the UK or UK can particularly afford to pretend it isn't happening. So I think this, like, let it bed down. doing after action, post-mortem lessons learned. And then I think both jurisdictions really need to sort of come up with a plan for the sake of, sanity in the industry to come up with their T+1 plans. And I think ultimately the UK and EU will be, whether they say it out loud, given the political sensitivities, or silently agree, will align themselves to sort of move roughly at the same time. And so I think if Europe came out and said, we can do it in 28, the UK would find some excuse to do in 28, because there'd be no advantage in like doing a year in advance. So I think, sort of, I made a joke on Twitter, post Brexit, the UK's financial regulation basically can align with the US or the EU. Like, there really is no magical third way to lead the way on almost anything. So it's really which way do they want to go? And I think in almost anything, aligning with the EU makes more sense.
Given the flows, it's not the EU loving tofu wokarate, right? It's not.
Oh yeah, no, yeah. Like, this is just a pure, like, this has nothing to do with, like, even if you hated the EU from a pure logistical standpoint, and the work and the flows, like, being out of step would be insane. Like, it's a terrible idea.
Exactly.
I love the thought of someone in that task force, sitting there with GB News on in one hand. We've got to do this now, tomorrow. Europe did put out its own. It was a summary of the responses they got from their own consultation. So nothing concrete. But did you get a chance to read that? It was quite interesting. Everything was, well, I say it's not really different for the UK because it was split again. But there was people on both sides of the fence. I think the only concrete takeaway was, okay, we won't do T0, which should go without saying, really, at this point.
Yes. I mean, well, I'm glad they said that, because in the US they haven't said that, right? Gensler's gung-ho for T+0, which is madness. But and we're not leading down that path. And hopefully in the UK we won't either, but you never know. But I think with regards to the summary, because there was like eight, was 80 plus responses, and you have a massive array of different market participants that have different views on this stuff. And actually, listening to that roundtable, as I mentioned in the last episode, you could hear the voices of all the different people, and some are really pushing for 2026, which is again nuts. But that's because they don't have to do any of the work. I think anyone that has to do the work is pushing for a sensible timeline, and trying to bear in mind existing settlement rates and stuff. And actually, saying that, on that note, we've also seen the European Central Bank put out the T2S stats for last year, didn't they, recently? Which shows that settlement efficiency rates have improved, at least cross-border anyway, which is, a good indicator. So they've come down to around about 3%, I think, wasn't it? Round about, just above 3%, which is good for the equity space. Although we haven't seen bonds yet.
Yeah, I'm just looking now. We ran the story on it 2 days ago, so yeah, that looks about right. Is that everything settlement? That's a lot of
Well, there was
settlement.
CSDR,
CSDR?
CSDR.
Yes, yeah. Okay, just when we thought we were out. Virginia, you're putting us back in. What's going on
Oh
with
no, you can't
CSDR?
escape it. No, there were so many consultations over the last couple of months. So the CSDR consultation closed on. Well, we've just got the list of responses. We don't have the response from ESMA about the responses, if that makes sense. But we've certainly seen that there's been a lot of feedback on that, and there's actually common themes on that. It's less disparity, I think. Lots of voices saying, no, we don't want to see penalty rates going up, unsurprisingly.
Yeah, shocking.
It's progressive penalties, isn't it? So
Yes.
it's not rates going up just for, the same amount of time of settlement. I'm assuming it's progressive for how long the trade fails.
Exactly. Yeah. And but it's like increasing by an exponential rate day per day per day. So just to try and push people to address those underlying problems, which I think, I don't think anybody wants to see happen, because it would make, the numbers that I put out there even scarily higher. So, which, they're already high.
It doesn't seem a bad idea to dangle a few threats, though, in
No.
terms of, if the buy-ins are still out there, the mandatory
Yes.
buy-ins are still looming.
That's
If those do disappear.
next year's because it said 2025 has said make a decision on that, right?
With no benchmark to what that decision might be. But
Indeed.
I think it's not a bad thing. I mean, we're still the fines still aren't being passed on to the buy side, from what I understand.
No. Well, I mean, it's relatively complicated in the way that the accounting works. I think one of the things that should be introduced is a minimum threshold for penalties, because when you've got these tiny ones flying about, they don't help anybody. So I think that's part. I think the feedback was common. I'm just trying to remember if it was common that everybody thought that there should be a minimum boundary. I think everybody agreed that.
Mm. Quite exciting, the world assessment. I wonder, for the next episode, we should all come up with a Netflix drama with a cast and a storyline on you know, how we can portray this.
We'd have to have Vlad Tenev as the ultimate villain for kicking all this stuff off, right? just in my opinion.
I saw you put a vote up about who should pay Gary Gensler in the film. I saw you took my Paul Giamatti reference.
Yeah, he won.
He won. Yeah, of course he did. It's slam dunk. Absolutely. He'd be fantastic. Who else did you have on there?
Montgomery Burns.
Okay. That's why.
No, there was a few others. I think, what was his name? Gary Oldman was one of them, because he can do character quite well.
Yeah.
And somebody else. Yeah. I can't remember who the other one was.
So I think that's pretty much... all the settlement talk. Look, there's a few other things that have been going on. Maybe we can save it for another episode. Why don't we just finish off with the SBF trial? We already closed off Bitcoin in the last episode and said we wouldn't talk about it again, but I feel like this is the final chapter of that book. 25 years? Did that surprise you, Sean?
Yeah, I thought it was a little light. I wasn't in the camp. I thought he was going to get like under 10, but I thought 25 years was a little light, and I would have thought he was going to, my guess was sort of the 30 to 40, 45 range.
I think because they took off a lot of the other stuff off the table, didn't they? All that, and I'm sure I've seen you tweeted about this as well, but like they've took off the campaign financing and stuff off the table. If that had been taken into account, I think it would have been longer, right?
I have a real problem with that. Yeah, they took off the campaign finance violations and the Foreign Corrupt Practice Act violations. They decided not to pursue those charges, which I think doesn't help keep the tinfoil hat brigade at bay around the system being rigged. So, you know, and in their sort of, in its sentencing, the DOJ basically said that SBF committed the largest election crime in U.S. history and one of the largest bribes ever in U.S. history. And so that alone should push him over 25 years when you include the sort of massive fraud he perpetrated. So I find it really sort of odd that he didn't get a higher sentence, let alone them not pursuing those charges for the sake of sort of systemic integrity. But I think it's a little low, but I think, you know, 25 out in 21 years, I think, is the federal guideline. So he'll be in his 50s. And I know everyone's pretending, but mine is screaming like his life will be over. But when you get closer to 50, that doesn't seem as old as people seem to think it is. And he's sort of been unrepentant. You know, if you look at it at sentencing, he thought when he made his statement in his press statements afterward, he fundamentally doesn't think he did anything wrong.
Yeah.
And so, like, he will, there, more likely than not, do financial crime again if given the opportunity. I mean, like recidivism is really high when it comes to white collar crime, especially when they have no empathy and don't believe they did anything wrong. So I really do think that, like, it wouldn't surprise me if he gets out and does crime again in 20 years. You know, like, it's just sort of, so I really do think that we, to protect society from people like that, he probably should have been in jail for, you know, closer to 30 or 40 years.
He is the Sideshow Bob of crypto. He's coming out of jail and coming after.
Well, also, he has like a web of enablers. Like, you look at the press, like the amount of people who are willing to make excuses for him is unbelievable. And partly it's because, you know, the crypto rebound has made his crimes seem less bad. You know, there's an insane idea out there that because people are getting their money back, there was no crime. I mean, that's like saying if I steal your car and the police recover it, I didn't do anything wrong. It's absolutely lunacy. Like, but the amount of people who are willing to apologize or minimize his crimes is crazy, which leads you to believe that, like, because he has no empathy and clearly did crimes intentionally, that he'll do it again. So I really, like, I think we need to, like, 150 years, whatever the sentencing guidelines was crazy, and that's, you know, that no one should be in jail for 150 years. But like, I this idea that like he's learned his lesson and won't do it again is bananas.
True, and what's going to happen to his family members that were also involved in the crimes? That's an interesting thing, right?
Yeah, like I mean, like looking at the civil cases against them and all the available evidence, it's pretty clear his parents were active participants in his crimes and did illegal things themselves. But this is where it goes to like where they drop the other charges. There seems to be this idea that we should just draw a line under the FTX fraud because we caught SBF and he's gone to jail, but like. A lot of crime happened there, and a lot of crime we haven't really dug into. And I'm a little disappointed that there isn't a push to sort of root out the rest of it. Like it does sort of seem like we're just going to close a chapter on this and not really look any deeper, which is disappointing.
It was an embarrassing episode for a lot of different market participants, I guess, and also politicians. So
and Tom, right. And Tom Brady.
Yes. True.
Well, look, it does, like Sean said, it kind of does close the chapter on it. I feel like it's the end of an era for us. You know, the Bitcoin ETF's approved, the SBF trial's over. We're going to have to really dramatize SAB 121 a little bit to keep it exciting, I think. There's some good cases going on there. But look, let's save that to another episode. We've gone pretty long on the settlement chat today. So Virginie, Sean, thanks so much for your thoughts today. Virginie, what are you working on at the moment?
Actually, another interesting topic for future is looking at AI and governance and things around that. So there was some interesting stuff the SEC did this month on AI. So some actions they took against investment advisors about AI washing. So ooh. Big topic.
Cool. Yeah, we should talk about that. That sounds interesting.
Yep.
Absolutely. Sean, where can people find your thoughts and views?
Well, as always, you can check me out, follow me on Twitter or FinReg Memes are your thing. Check out FinReg Memes on Instagram.
If people are listening in, I imagine that is their thing. So you follow Sean. Yeah, thanks everyone for listening and we'll see you again next time.
You were listening to There's Always a FinReg Angle podcast from Global Custodian. Stream on Google and Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or catch up wherever you get your podcasts from.